when we find a community of support, whether that be Alcoholics Anonymous or a community of triathlon or endurance or business group or a mastermind or whatever it may be, a community that's specifically designed to help you through the problems that you're collectively facing is the path to healing.
Welcome to the Learn It All podcast with your hosts, Learn It CEO, Damon Lemby, and SVP of Product, Darren Bridget. Our mission is to explore how continuous growth shapes the path to success. Our guests are high achievers who've learned there's always something new to discover. They'll share their stories, strategies, and insights with you. So whether you're a budding entrepreneur, a seasoned executive, an aspiring athlete, or simply someone who believes in the lifelong pursuit of knowledge, this podcast is for you. Join us now for the latest episode as we continue the Learn It All's journey through a world that never stops teaching.
Welcome to another episode of the Learn It All podcast. Why should you never take driving advice from an executive coach? Because they will always tell you to go the extra mile. I'm terrible at puns, but joining me, Damon Lemby, CEO of Learn It, and Courtney Ritchie, head of learning experience at Learn It, today is Adam Hill, who's done over, I think, 3,000 pun wars, I think he said. Adam is also a nine-figure CEO of a family business. He's a best-selling author, TED Talk speaker, and he's the host of Fear Overflow. Adam, welcome to the show. Can you give us a little bit more background about yourself?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Damon, Courtney. I'm so honored to be here. And by the way, that first joke about driving and executive coaching, that was really funny. So sorry, my piece.
Really funny. How do you come up with these so quickly? I'm terrible at that. How do you come up with them so quickly?
I think like anything, it's a muscle that you build, right? I mean, like, so over the course of years, every single day, just doing it a little bit at a time. Plus, you know, there's it's like a royalty-free exercise. Like everybody, they're free for the taking. Offline, we were talking about the tooth, the going to the dentist at tooth 30 joke. And that's just kind of like an open source. Everybody can take it. So once you learn them all, you just have this repertoire of dad jokes that you could tell. So yeah, but
the tooth 30 joke, and I said this on your show, literally, that's my six-year-old daughter's favorite joke, and I've heard it 100 times.
That's right. Yep. At least 75 of those, I'm guessing, were from her, and then 25 elsewhere, right? It's just something you want to repeat. A little bit about me. I grew up in a family-run chemical company called Hill Brothers Chemical Company. By the time I was born, the company was 65 years old, something like that, or 55 years old at the time I was born. I can't do math at that high level. So right now we just celebrated our 101st birthday last month. So that was exciting. I grew up in kind of a middle-class family business home, two parents who loved each other, not a whole lot of conflict growing up or anything like that. It was actually pretty good childhood. And started realizing, my history has a lot of anxiety in the back of it. I had a lot of anxiety. I tended to err on the side of just being fearful of a lot of things. So my childhood and into college, was pretty much shadowed by a really high level anxiety disorder that turned into panic attacks when I was in college and really dark times where I started getting into alcohol and became a full blown alcoholic by the time I was in college. And that progressed for about a decade throughout the early part of my career, where I started working in Hill Brothers. And I kind of balanced my time between drinking at night to kind of numb the anxiety and all of the shame and everything that was developing over time due to, basically self brought on trauma, and trying to work and get ahead in the company and work towards, all of achieving what I wanted to achieve, not just in my career, but I think the unspoken expectations that I felt that I had on myself to get to where I needed to be. So that was kind of the early part of my career and just kind of a nutshell of how I grew up and a little bit of background on me.
That's awesome. I want to start off and let's talk a little bit about your company. Today is actually, it's ironic. I was mentioning to you that backstage that today is Learn It. Today's June 4th that we're recording this 2024. And today is our 29th anniversary, not quite 101, but you know, it's been an amazing journey. And, but yeah, share with us a little bit more about how, where you, when you started working at your company, how it was interacting with, I assume your father and maybe even your grandfather. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those are very tough shoes to fill. They're also tough. I think my experience was, you know, making everybody know that you're there for the right intentions, that you want to roll up the sleeves and you weren't just given a silver spoon to be there. So yeah, tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. So by the time I entered into the company, it was a third generation run business. So my dad was the CEO at mm-hmm. the time, and he had been since the early 90s. So by the time I came in around 2002, 2003, he'd already been in that role for about 10 years, which is interestingly enough about how long I've been in the role now myself. So, so he'd been in that role about that long. So my grandfather was still alive. He was, in the former generation, and, just a little bit of history. My great grandfather started the company. He passed it on to his four sons. And his four sons basically co-led the company for, once they took over in the second generation and basically took turns being the president and CEO of the company for, you know, every 4 years, kind of like the national, you know, the United States president. So then when they eventually all retired out, my dad replaced them. They were still around. They were on the board of directors. So there was a lot of family influence when I came into the role and a lot of family legacy that was brought into that. I came in working in our research and development lab as a quality control administrator. And that was my role for a few years. And I think in those early years, it was definitely, you could feel the weight of, you have to earn this on your own. There's no handouts. There's no like special treatment. In fact, a lot of us in that whole role, we would see that we would have to, you know, work a little harder to make sure we had the, you know, that we could get, you know, to where we wanted to go. Because there was always that sense around it too. Like, you know, you're a hill, you have a leg up in this company. Meanwhile, we don't really, you know, have that. So I was very conscious of that and had to work my way up. I went from working in the lab to applying for a job in sales in 2007. I wanted to sell our construction line of products, which was a deck coating line. We sold deck coatings for different, you know, flooring and deck sealers, products like that. And so I entered into that role in November of 2007, which was the exact wrong time to enter into a construction line in sales, because right. immediately, yeah, 2 weeks later after I entered into that role.
Great recession.
Yes. So I had quite a few really lean years after that. But that was kind of how I got started. But it was a valuable experience in the sense that that I knew that I at least had to really be resourceful and learn my own way to get to where I wanted to be.
Yeah, and I bet Damon can identify with this just because he was similarly doing a renaissance when he came in to Learn It and did every role he could because he wanted to experience what the company truly did from the ground up. What was your favorite job there before you were CEO?
Favorite job? I love to build things like and really I found pretty early on that I just love to think about the future and the vision of what things look like 10 years mm-hmm. from now. And so I got into a role after I was in sales where I was going to build a centralized customer service division. And from that, I could actually look at where we were and what was broken, what needed fixing, and look ahead and look at what the teams look like and look at what the systems look like on where that existed. Mm-hmm. So that gave me a good opportunity to just really visualize and and envision and systemize and create this division that could be self-sufficient and really support the company. And today, it is a centralized division. It's a very key role in what we do. I have an opinion that most family businesses out there, and maybe Damon, you can resonate with this, are not only family focused, but also very customer service, very service oriented, to the point where we want to make sure that we have a high quality of service. And that was really something, a key part of what made me happy about building that division.
So your company is in its 101st year, and how has it been taking it from, let's say, a legacy, you know, things are done this way, to modernizing it? Were there struggles internally for you to be able to get your word in there? You know, outside of just Learn It, which of course I love, we, for a long time, we had a massive real estate company and a hotel chain. And I'd always have conversations with my brother around real estate and my aunt for our hotels. And we're always kind of joking and laughing about how it was, hey, you know, Walt and Frank, my dad and my grandfather, this is how they want to do it. And kind of the struggles to be able to, you know, on one hand, you want to keep the legacy and everything they've done. But on the other hand, you really want to figure out how can we move this forward to be successful and evolve?
Yeah, that's a great question, Matt, because I think that there's a blessing and a curse of being a legacy company that's long term, whether it's, you know, 29 years old or 101 years old. I think the blessing of it, the beauty of it, is that you're so bought into core values and legacy and wanting to preserve that and make sure that those last, that legacy, that those core values last. But I think the curse is that alongside that legacy and those core values come these sacred cows. The idea is that, like, that's the way we've always done it, or, you know, this is the legacy. And I think the trap that we get into, where we get into those sacred cows, is those really become anchors to our company's progress, to moving us forward in the right direction. So I think we need to shift our perspective on what legacy really means. I think when we tend to think of legacy, we think about the past. We think about what did the founder represent, which is important. You know, what did the founder, what did our predecessors represent? What did they want to bring to the world? But legacy, in my opinion, is more about the future. It's about what we represent and how we're building out to what we want our company or our family or our communities to look like 7 generations down the line. And I think that so I think that the power, if we can shift our perspective on legacy, we can start to entrench ourselves more in our core values and not so much in our sacred cows. We can start getting curious about where our business is going, and we start putting a vision together that not only supports and sustains us now and provides the lifestyle that we want, but also builds a future for the generations that are to come and that may want to work here, so that they want to be bought into it, that they want to create, and that they want to create their legacy for the next generations down the line.
And that's a really interesting thought, because I feel like, you know, Learn It can certainly resonate only in 29 years, very similar evolutions. I want to ask a question based off of something I heard on your podcast when I was listening to it, about this concept of organizations being like a family. Right. That's kind of a taboo thing to say now. You know, you don't want to confuse business with family, because they're such different entities. So you talk a little bit about shifting more of a tribal culture, right? More of a team-based culture. Can you talk a little bit about that and, you know, what impact that has and what steps you took to shift that, you know, being a company that probably felt very familial for many, many years?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's benefits to being you know, when we think about family, I mean, a lot of us can have a very warm reception to that note. Like, hey, yeah, I love my family. My parents were great, all that. Some people don't have that warm of a feeling about family. So when they might not feel that, or when they're, you know, coming into a company where we're saying, hey, yeah, we're welcoming you as family, it's like, oh, great. You know, I know how my relationship is with my brother, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think that there's more, it's more prone to, you know, maybe some of the negative family aspects that exist in life. And I know that this is a bit of a contrarian view, and I totally get that. But coming from a family business, what I've seen is the idea that if we associate more as a tribe, you know, throughout our human history, human beings on every continent in every part of the world came up, evolutionarily speaking, in tribes, and that's how they progressed. Not in just the family units, which were components of that, but the broader tribe. And the benefit of thinking in terms of a tribal unit is a tribe has kind of the same set of values, same set of vision, same thing that they want for the company, and they're all working toward that greater good of what they want to achieve in their community or in the world. So that tribal aspect is such a key component of how we look and how we move forward in the world. So I think it's good to try to get everybody into, I think evolutionarily speaking, and from a human psychology standpoint, we all want to be part of a community. We all have a family, whether we like it or not, of some kind or another. But we all want to be a part of a community where we're all working toward the common goals, the common good. And that means that we can bring people in that are aligned and that want to work towards the same goals as us. That's kind of my philosophy on moving more towards the tribal element versus the family element.
That's great. Thank you for answering that. That's something that comes up a lot, right?
We want
to make sure that we're keeping that sense of community, but staying focused on that we have business outcomes to achieve at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that is first and foremost is the greater good. And if we're putting that aside in the favor of like, well, I've got to look after, you know, my son or my daughter or however this looks, which is terrific. We want to do that. But the greater good, the community, the tribe is what allows that to happen as well. So if we can take care of the tribe element first, then we can take care of the family.
One of the things we talked about a little bit backstage too, and I think this helps with vision and execution, is you're going to implement an EOS system, right? There's a fabulous book out there by, I think it's Gino Wickman, called Traction. Can you share with us a little bit about your journey with EOS or where you started? And I'm sure Courtney's got some thoughts and ideas on it, because Learnit actually is a big believer in EOS as well.
Yeah, EOS has changed our business and really, to be honest, changed my life. Because kind of coming into the CEO role, and I wonder how you kind of feel about this, Damon, like coming into that role after working in the company, I feel like I had a good rounding of you know, what the company represented, how we grew up, how I grew up in the business. And even though I had a good foundation of working in a variety of departments and everything like that, once I got into that leadership role, once that CEO position, the weight of family, the business, the decisions, and everything else, you know, I feel the weight of that. And on top of that, something I didn't expect is that even within a family, family business, it felt very lonely. It felt like, you know, I was alone. There wasn't a lot of, I didn't feel like, you know, that more people were coming to me as the CEO than as Adam, you know, the friend, the family, the brother, the you know, all that. And so those first few years, I kind of floundered. I struggled to really get my feet under me and figure out what I was doing and where the business was going and how the legacy was going to turn forward. There was an identity crisis, not just in me, but in the business in general. And on top of that, we entered into, you know, this was 2019. We went into COVID, where that, you know, changed the nature of all businesses everywhere and kind of put everybody in a level playing field of working through that. So amidst all that, I was lucky enough to discover and find EOS through a mastermind that I was a part of, and read Gino's book Traction, and then subsequently started reading all of his other stuff, and found an EOS implementer, and it changed the way we did business. The reason I think that it was so powerful for us, and if you're listening to this and you're not sure what EOS is or you have no clue, it's basically a system of doing business that accounts for, you know, six different elements of, you know, people, data, meeting pulses and all sorts of stuff. I can't name them off the top of my head, but but what it does is it brings together a greater system of communication, accountability, and most importantly, I think for me, was it took the weight of the decisions completely solely off my shoulders and put it onto the system. it gave us a real visibility into what our vision is. It spread that out to our whole organization so that everybody could see what we wanted to do in the world and what we wanted to become. And sure enough, in doing that and in spreading that, things did not get perfect, and they never will. We don't expect that. But in fact, I think for a time we actually saw it look like we were doing worse than we did, because more of those unforeseen issues or challenges that we had started coming to the surface, and we realized that they were actually there. They were being suppressed for a long time, but they were coming up. But over time, we were able to work through them to the point where, you know, we grew our revenues by 40 or 50%. We started getting more on track. We've put ourselves on a sustainability path that we can exist. We can be a sustainable company for the next four generations. So EOS is a very powerful tool for us. And for me, I've implemented into our family, our life, and it's just served a lot of value for what we do.
You have a 5-year goal tracker for your family?
We do. Yeah.
How many kids do you have, Adam?
We have two kids. We have a 16-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old son. And we have our level 10 meeting every week. I have a level 10 meeting with our
family.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's fantastic. So
Courtney's going to implement that. I can guarantee it.
Oh my goodness. My kids are younger, but they'll figure it out.
Yeah. So we just went through this past week, and if you interviewed my kids, they probably wouldn't say the same thing. Maybe they're bored with it, but I think we went through our core values exercise this past week, and we determined what their core values were. And just having that visibility for myself as a parent into what my kids found as their core values, like their individual, that's going to be able to guide, you know, my wife and myself in terms of how we communicate with them, how we motivate them, how we encourage them to move forward. It allows them to look at that and have visibility in that self-awareness with themselves to know what those values are and start making decisions early and often on those values. I mean, those values are so important. And another lesson that we taught them was that those values evolve over time. You know, that they're not meant to be like set in stone. They're meant to be revisited quarterly to see if this is really still what we represent. Do we want to represent something different? Do we want to represent something more? And so we're encouraging them to look at those core values quarterly and evolve them and do that. So I mean, we haven't seen it yet. They're 16 and 13, but I think that there's a powerful foundation that could be built there.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought up the concept that values can evolve, especially teenagers. I mean, that concept of what their identities and their values are should evolve at that age, right?
I don't
expect values at 13 to be the same at 23. And I think the same can apply for organizations, even ones that are 100 plus years, 29 years deep. You know, we found going through the EOS that there was some surprises when we were looking at our values and what we wanted to be and where we wanted to be in 5 years. I'm curious, you know, when you were going through those exercises, you mentioned it got worse before it got better, which our implementer warned us of, right?
Same thing.
We experience a little bit of that drawdown, and you articulate it so beautifully that it highlights some of the things you didn't even realize weren't functioning well. What would you say was the biggest thing, biggest challenge identified in that to overcome? And how did that, you know, impact the staff, right? Your employees, you have 150 employees, and you have to get them on board with this concept of things are going to be a little bit tough as we're trying to course correct. How did you let them know this is all part of a bigger plan?
Yeah, great question. I think that one of the biggest things that came up that we may not have been aware of was that I think one of the, and this was hard to really grasp at the time. I think my dad was CEO for 25 years, and he did an amazing job. Grew the business significantly, made it what it is today. And I think, you know, even before, as kind of a preamble to what I'm about to say, I think it's important to recognize that in some way, as leaders of an organization, we are doing something now that is going to become something that is not the right path in the future, right? So something that the next generation will have to fix. something that's working now that we'll have to fix. And part of our culture, I think, was a culture of care and love and family that, you know, everybody loved. And it was great. And it worked for us for decades, to the point where, you know, we developed a culture on the difficult side of that, of non-confrontation, of artificial harmony, to the point where people didn't feel like maybe they had the ability to speak up or say the hard thing or engage in healthy conflict. And that was a hard one for me to grasp, because growing up, I had anxiety. I was conflict avoidant. I still am, to an extent, very conflict avoidant. So kind of leaning into that idea that healthy conflict is good was a big cultural shift for us, but a powerful one. And I think it was one that didn't take away from the care and compassion that we had as such a clear core value, which is still one of our core values. It actually added on to that core value when we actually decided, hey, we can engage in healthy conflict and say the things that we may not have wanted to say in the past, and you know, go into the dark forest and, you know, face those monsters so that we can collectively get better. So that was, I think, the biggest thing. How we communicated that, I think it's still something we're actively trying to communicate and work through. And our leadership, and it starts from, you know, our senior leadership team throughout our quarterlies, our level 10s, we have engaged in that kind of healthy conflict. We have done so in a fact that we've tried to balance that side of avoiding artificial harmony and avoid being mean-spirited. So we find that balance, and we try to spread that down to our management team. And then, of course, kind of just percolate it through leading by example.
Adam, whether it's EOS or any other type system, you know, you have to get buy-in from leadership. Mm-hmm. And because I believe if you don't get buy-in from leadership, it's going to fail. What advice do you have? I'm thinking of somebody I know who's considering rolling out EOS, but they may not, and they're one of the executives, but they may have a challenge with the implementation and the buy-in from the other senior executives. Do you think that they should just not do it at all, or do you have like maybe some stepping stones or ideas they could do to try to get buy-in from the rest of the leadership team?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's always, that's a hard one, because I was challenged with that as well. Is you know, there's a lot of skepticism when you're going to bring in a new system, and I think one of what worked, I guess I could speak well to that for what worked well for us, and you know, what worked well for us is that we were in a time where it was clear that something had to change. That there were not systems in place, that we didn't have the right set of communications or systems. So finding the issues that we clearly needed to fix and bringing those to the surface allowed us to say, well, what can we use to fix this? And so when we were able to bring something forward like EOS and say, hey, this addresses, you know, the issues that we face. This gives us a platform on where we can address these issues clearly. It gives us an ability to address the right people, right seats issues that we've been talking about for years. It gives us, you know, this platform to have a set of core values. I feel like for us, leading with the clear issues that we had at the time and finding where this system could actually solve it was a key way of bringing it in the door. Then once it was in the door and once it was up for discussion, I think allowing that discussion to actually happen, finding out if it is legitimately right for you, because forcing anything down a set of senior executive certs is going to be difficult. Either they're not going to take it in and it's not going to work, or you're eventually going to have to draw the line and say, look, this is what we're doing. You're either in or you're out. So you have to be willing to go either of those directions and either let go of it completely, realize that it's not the right system for you, or be willing to make the dramatic changes that you're going to need to bring it in. So I think just getting real with that, if you're as a leader, a senior leader, are fully bought into it, you know, first know definitively what issues is this going to solve. And if it's nothing, if it's just a gut feeling for you, maybe you need to work a little bit harder to get to get more clarity on that. Because frankly, as EOS worked great for us, it's not for everybody. And, you know, and there's a million other systems on there. And I believe that a business has to operate on a system. It's kind of like the idea of making decisions. If you're not making any decisions, not making a decision is a decision in and of itself. No system is a system. So, you know, you just have to kind of think of it that way.
So, fantastic advice. Switching gears, earlier we were talking about, I heard you talk about, you know, anxiety, fear, even maybe imposter syndrome. I've been there as well. And I used to overcome that with drinking, right? Yeah. I mean, it numbed the pain for relieved that anxiety. And, you know, I quit drinking 8 years ago. Funny enough, my final drink was at Courtney's engagement party. I called up. I went with a couple of employees afterwards, good friends, Jamie Tadlock and Evans Hood. And I said, hey, this is my, order whatever you want. This is my final bottle of wine. Nobody believed me, but I did it. And as we've spoken before on your show, it was one of the greatest decisions I've ever made. Can you share with us a little bit about your journey and how it's impacted, you know, first of all, how'd you get sober and how it's impacted you both as a leader and also as a parent?
Yeah. Sobriety is the greatest gift I've ever received. And everything that I have now is on borrowed time. And, you know, in a nutshell, I realized that I had no control over drinking anymore. I should have realized that much earlier, but I realized it when I got into a DUI accident in 2012. And it was at that time sitting in a jail cell, thinking about the person that I was that I never wanted to be. I never wanted to hurt anybody. I never wanted to be an alcoholic. Growing up, nobody in my life was an alcoholic or an addict. So that was always something that was way on the periphery in the DARE program, you know, where we looked at alcoholics or drug addicts as people that were sleeping behind dumpsters because they had it so bad. But I was going to work. I was doing my job. I was doing, you know, things that normal people do, but I still had no control over it. It had complete control over me. You know, the point where in a blackout, I got behind the wheel and drove and nearly, and could have killed somebody. Fortunately that didn't happen. And fortunately I was by grace or whatever, given another chance. And that was my last drink, in 2012, over 12 years ago. And I entered an AA program the very next day after walking out of the jail cell and went every day for a year and then continued to basically just make sobriety my lifestyle to the point where, you know, over time, it's not an easy process getting sober, and I don't want to minimize it, but, you know, to the point now where I look at alcohol as not just something that's not for me, not just because I can't drink it or it's, but something to me that is just, there's no use for it, that it does not serve any purpose in our society, that there's no good, at least there's no good purpose for it to be as a consumable, in my opinion. And that's not to yuck anybody else's yum who likes wine or anything like that, but it's the feeling I have about it over time as I've developed it. My life has gotten so good in sobriety that I see no use for it whatsoever. And I pray every morning that feeling in my mind continues and that I don't have the desire to drink again.
You know, I'm really interested in what you had talked about in terms of your sobriety and how it tied into your anxiety disorder. I know you refer to your anxiety disorder, sometimes you reframe it as a superpower. Yeah. You know, as someone who, as a normal person, especially a mom, a working mom, I am no stranger to the concepts of anxiety. So I'm really curious about how you remember. Well, you know, a little bit. But I'd love to know how you got to the point where you were able to reframe that. And did that come through your journey into sobriety? Or was that a byproduct of it?
Yeah, I think when I started drinking, I didn't know that alcohol would be the thing that helped alleviate my anxiety at that time. But the first drink that I had, in, you know, when I went to visit the college that I would ultimately go to, UCSB, which
here you go.
It's known as a drinking school. I'm not going to lie. But, you know, I so my first drink there, it was just like this feeling, this immediate like realization. This was the thing that was solving my problems. I didn't know that I had like problems at that time, but I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm social. I can actually speak to girls. I could actually, you know, be social and enjoy life. And that kind of became the catalyst for what would become a real significant drinking problem. And so I think that was my relationship with fear as I got into college, because that's ultimately when the panic attacks started too. And I realized that by drinking, I could suppress the panic attacks, the constant panic and anxiety that I would have, the fear of actually walking out of my house to go to a class, you know, having to interact with other people, or you know, this complete anxiety that was constantly consuming me. And so that was kind of my relationship with alcohol for the next decade. It was dealing with the crippling panic and anxiety on a day-to-day basis during the course of the day, and then drinking myself into numbness at night to kind of suppress it. That was it. And then when I had the DUI accident, I realized that, okay, these things are coming to a head. Now I'm not just a danger to myself. I'm a danger to others. And you know, I felt complete hopelessness in the jail cell, to the point where I did consider, you know, taking my life, because it was just that, it was that all consuming. I didn't know how to get over what I was experiencing. And I didn't tell anybody. I didn't talk to anybody about it because I felt like I was alone. I felt like what I was experiencing was lonely. I didn't know that other people experienced this kind of shame or panic or anything like that. But what happened was, you know, thankfully I chose to walk into a community of help. And what I realized is that we can not necessarily get over our fears. We can face our fears and learn to actually embrace our fears. When we find a community of support, whether that be Alcoholics Anonymous or a community of triathlon or endurance or business group or a mastermind or whatever it may be, a community that's specifically designed to help you through the problems that you're collectively facing is the path to healing. That's the first step in path to healing. Vulnerability in that community is another part of that healing. And when you can go through that, when you can join that community and vulnerably express what you're feeling, what you're experiencing, you do not only just start to heal, but you actually start to see the superpower that exists in that. And for me, with fear was nothing more. Fear was something that was terrorizing me for years, or what I felt like, right? But at that point, fear just became a signal. It was a signal for things that were trying to grab at my attention and tell me something, that either this was a danger that I had to avoid, but in most cases, it wasn't a danger, because I wasn't like facing anything that was life-threatening. In most cases, it was an opportunity to just lean into that fear a little bit and grow. And the case in point was when I started to pursue triathlon, something that terrified me. I didn't want to swim in the ocean, like 2 miles in the ocean, no way. But there was a fear there. And I realized that in a year into sobriety, after having these tools and being immersed in that community, I realized that maybe if I lean into that fear, maybe if I lean into that fear a little bit, that fear is telling me that that could be an opportunity to grow. And that's the lesson. So to Damon's question earlier about, you know, what lessons, how do I take that into leadership? Well, now within sobriety, I have that clarity where that fear comes in and now I have a relationship with it. It very rarely causes panic attacks anymore, though it still does creep in. It still causes anxiety, but it's also a signal that maybe there's something there to look at a little bit more closely. That might be an opportunity to grow. And that's how I kind of see that in business. It's how we implemented EOS. It's how we implemented various programs. I think it's how we grew to where we were, is because we collectively as a team started to lean into that fear a little bit, to go into the dark forest and face some of those fears and grow.
Before we get off of this topic, I want to talk about a different fear. And I know that you're considering pivoting your podcast to multi-generational families, but also maybe helping leaders who are considering getting sober or are sober. Mm-hmm. And one of the big challenges I had that I worked through, but a lot of people who are friends of mine who are considering maybe stopping drinking, they're like, well, how am I going to do that? How am I going to go to a business function where everything is surrounded by drinking? What advice do you have for somebody like ourselves of dealing with that initially?
Yeah, I think initially it's hard, and I don't want to minimize it because I went through it, you know, just having to go to cocktail parties and all of that stuff. Even today, where people know me as a sober person, I'm very open about it. I'll still get emails, solicitations saying, "Hey, I have a free bottle of wine for you if you have a conversation with me." And my response is usually, "You have not researched me at all." But I think that my advice to anybody that's struggling with that is club soda is your friend. You know, always carrying a glass of club soda. Depending on how open you want to be about that. I tend to, unless this is something you want to work through with a therapist, with your sobriety team, whatever that may be, AA or however that is. But I believe, at least for me, that being open and honest about my sobriety was kind of one of the biggest steps I took towards actually healing through it. It took a couple of years from my point of sobriety to actually start being open about it. But when I started being open about that sobriety, it imprinted it as part of my identity. And so I realized, I think after those first couple of years, that the anonymity part was starting to become a bit of a crutch for me. So now it's like people know me as that, and now I can do that. But I think it's also important to recognize too, that there's a bit of a movement happening within executive leadership or entrepreneurship or high achievers in general where I hear a lot more those people saying, alcohol is just not serving me anymore and I'm not doing it. So even just making it a lifestyle choice, there is no shame in that. Even when people line up the tequila like shots and say, "Hey, we're taking shots," you could just be like, "No, this is a lifestyle choice for me right now." I say, own it. Own it as a source of empowerment. That sobriety is a powerful tool for you, and even offer maybe to be the designated driver. That may be the biggest selling point to whoever you might be trying to sell that night or whatever. There's opportunities there to just really lean into yourself authentically. And I think the key is just not associating it yourself and really looking at your motives for why you want to keep that sobriety a secret or why you want to avoid it. Is there still a little bit of deeper shame there that you have to work through? But don't associate the sobriety with shame. Work towards getting to the root of the shame that you're feeling. But the sobriety part of it is not a source of shame in of itself.
I agree. I mean, I think it's almost cool these days to be sober.
Yeah.
You know, it's really took me a little bit, but yeah, I owned it. And now people admire it and they're pretty cool about it. You know, I know we're running up on time, but I want to talk about your TEDx and the experience of getting, you know, approved to do it and a little bit about your talk around puns and communities.
Yes. Yeah. It was exciting. So it's always been on my bucket list to do a TED talk, and there was a subject that I was very, very, that spoke to me very, very well. And I had a TEDx coach named Cesar Cervantes, who was incredible. He helped me a lot to get onto that stage. And we worked through kind of setting this topic together. And when we talked through it, when we kind of brainstormed it, I was like, yeah, that's the thing. So for about 8 years now, ever since about 2015, I've been posting a pun a day on Facebook, just been posting a stupid dad joke. And the reason I started doing that was I found that I was starting to get immersed in all of the negativity, all of the just debate that's happening on social media that goes nowhere. And it was just this circular argument of like the politics and all of this kind of stuff. And I realized that it was just really affecting my mindset, really making me angry. And I think if you're, you know, maybe listeners out there may be thinking to themselves that that's how I feel. I hate that I go onto Facebook and I see these things that just trigger this sense inside of me. So in 2015, it was at the height of like the primary election season. And I decided to just start like rigorously unfollowing all of this, the political stuff, and then just posting a joke a day for 30 days. And it made me feel so much better. And what I realized through that process was that when I did that, when I posted something positive and creative, that people started to respond to that. People started to post their own puns. So that when I would go back to Facebook, I'd get that little notification that says somebody commented on your thing. It's a comment that wasn't a debate, wasn't telling me how wrong I was or what. It was just another dumb joke that I could laugh at. So throughout the course of this day, I created a community of people that could that just formed this positivity just simply by accident. And so the nature of my TED Talk was how to accidentally really create a community through small creative acts every day. In my case, it was puns. It was an awesome talk. It's very topical right now. I really enjoyed delivering it. And I think it's, if you're feeling like you're struggling through like all of the social media distraction and all that, this might be a good topic for you to listen to.
That was, I will say I was jotting down some of the run-ons with the state names. How am I going to do this when my husband gets home and just totally wow him? Because all of our jokes come from the dad joke books they get him every right. Christmas. No, they were original and good. And I really appreciated you sharing those. I'm just curious what one little question I have, and then I'll let Damon, bring us home. But, what are you reading right now that I should read?
Oh, okay. I am reading a good book, and I hope my parents aren't listening to this, but no, in all honesty, I think it's a book that should be required reading for everyone, and especially in family business. The book is called The Adult Children of Emotionally Immature Parents. Ooh. And so you could see how parents might like get this feeling of like, oh, what am I emotionally immature? No, that's not the nature of it. I think going back to my earlier point that all, even in business, we should all expect that we're doing something right now that is going to be something that's going to have to be repaired in the future. It kind of gives us that sense of humility. I think the reason I'm reading that book now is not because I feel like I've been harmed, but because I want to be self-aware of what I might have experienced, that the way I'm experiencing life based on how maybe my parents influenced me, but also how I'm parenting my kids and maybe how I might be influencing them with some of my emotional immaturity, and how that's coming out. So it's a very, very powerful book. I highly recommend it to anybody.
Breaking the cycle. I really like that. Thank you for that recommendation.
I'm gonna pick it up as well.
Yeah.
So one of our signature questions, Adam, that we have here, I mean, you've been incredibly open and transparent. One of our signature questions is, tell us something about you that most people are unaware of, that they don't know about you.
That's really hard to source, because I'm pretty much an open book. But I think that something people might not know about me is that every time I get in front of a camera or get on, a show like this, or step into a boardroom or face the day sober, I feel a sense of feeling like I'm a fraud, like I don't belong. And that is one of the lies that I'm telling myself, and I recognize it's a lie, but it is something that I have to actively work towards to get through. And so people might be feeling that too, in terms of like how they feel when they get onto things. But as I'm sitting here, it does come up that I feel like maybe I don't belong, or maybe I am a fraud. And so working through that is part of my daily routine.
It's nice to know we're not alone. We all suffer from imposter syndrome, right, Damon?
That's right. You better believe it. Thanks for sharing that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both for having me. This was awesome. I loved it.
Where can our listeners find out more about you? Where should they head over?
Yeah. So you can, if you're interested in dumb dad jokes or anything, or listening to any source of my podcasts going forward, my YouTube channel is youtube.com/@AdamHill. So remember the at sign. Oh, I'm sorry. Not Adam Hill. At Adam C. Hill. So remember at Adam Chill. That's where you want to find it. So, find me.
Had to.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's my middle name just happens to be C. Hill. So, and you can follow me on LinkedIn and all of that too. Adam C. Hill on LinkedIn too. So,
and we'll be sure to have those in the show notes so people awesome. Can find them.
Awesome.
As well as the recommendation of the books. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. This was awesome. Courtney, Damon, thank you so much for having me. This was awesome.
Adam, so thank you. You're awesome. For our listeners out there, if you enjoyed this episode, please like it, subscribe, share with your friends, and remember to always be curious, keep learning, and have a great day. See you, everybody. Bye.